Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island Beer Company, which brews beers that are highly rated by beer critics and beer lovers alike. More at gooseisland.com. We don't need to be the only beer you drink. We just want to be the best beer you drink.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and Jim, no doubt, The Replacements, one of the most important bands in our lives.
For sure.
Both as journalists and as fans. 80s Underground helped define it, 79 through 91, one of the most important bands in the world to the fans who loved them during that era.
Sell any records.
No big hits, but a huge influence on bands that came after. In that alternative rock era, a lot of bands influenced by The Replacements. Reunited in 2012, and the proof was there. The crowds that came out to see them were exponentially larger than the crowds that saw them in their original heyday.
The Mats, as fans always called them, never took themselves seriously. In fact, you know, famous for shooting themselves in the foot, drinking, self-destruction. That's part of the story, but it's not the whole story. People also know that Paul Westerberg is one of the most admired songwriters by everyone who's followed, people who really are not afraid to wear their heart on their sleeve, to talk deeply about serious issues, even in as silly a thing as rock and roll. The whole story, finally, after a decade of work by journalist Bob Mayer, has come out in this book, which is a real incredible feat, Trouble Boys, The True Story of The Replacements. And having Bob on the show gives us another excuse to look at this incredible career. Bob, thanks so much for coming on Sound Opinions.
Thanks for having me, guys. It's good to talk to both of you again.
The 10 years you put into this book, it is really the story of The Replacements, but also the story of a uniquely American rock band, the story of an era in rock history, the story of the power of art to help people escape.
Yeah, I did. Once I realized the weight of the story, the gravity of it, the depth and the scope, it felt like this was an opportunity to tell both a bigger and a smaller story, a story of an era in rock music, in the music business, in the way bands got together and took shape, and then also a smaller story in terms of the lives, the intimate details of this group of people's lives, and the tragedies and the triumphs of those lives. So it became much more than a story of just a rock band, I think, I hope.
Who were the four guys in The Replacements, and how did they end up making music together?
It's really, The Replacements were kind of a merger of a band, a pre-existing band called Dog Breath, which featured Bob Stinson, his younger brother Tommy Stinson, and Chris Mars, Bob on guitar, Tommy on bass, Chris on drums. And a fellow by the name of Paul Westerberg, who at that point was kicking around some South Minneapolis bands, mostly playing lead guitar and working as a janitor, and doing that only so he could pay for his guitar and amp. But and in the fall of 1979, they hooked up sort of both by accident and I guess by the hand of fate. Paul was walking back from his janitor job. And as he was walking back home, he heard this volume, this sound, this thing that sort of enraptured him. And as he drew closer to this basement, he heard this incredible thunder coming out of the basement. Unbeknownst to him, that was Dog Breath, the Stinson Brothers and Chris Mars playing. A couple months later, a mutual friend insisted that Paul come over and check out his friend Chris's band. And lo and behold, they pull up, and Paul pulls up and sees this band. It sounds like the stuff out of a movie, but it turns out, you know, it was true. In fact, he'd kind of been hearing them for months on his walk, wondering, who is this band? I'd sure like to join them. And it turns out it was the band, I guess, he was made for, and that they were made for each other.
Stay right there. Go no further.
So, to be clear, you know, Paul joined an existing band, it was really Bob's band, right?
In a sense, yeah. I mean, Dog Breath wasn't a band so much that was playing out. They were really just kind of a neighborhood band, a basement band. Occasionally they would play, you know, parties and local house things, but hadn't really gotten on a stage. Paul had sort of been on the stage a little bit, so it really was kind of Paul joining this existing group that really wasn't doing anything. So I think they found a kind of unified ambition, certainly Bob and Paul did, in wanting to get out of the basement and get on a real stage.
Well, who were those Stinson brothers, Bob, and how had they started making music?
They were all Minnesotans. Everybody in the band was native to Minnesota. Bob, though, was the product ultimately of some abuse and a very difficult childhood at the hands of essentially the person who was his stepfather and Tommy's father. And so the first decade of his life was really, he was victim of that. He got sent into the state juvenile system, juvenile jails, group homes, that kind of thing, and really began to sort of suffer the effects of the abuse, I think, that he had experienced as a child, which was both sexual, physical, mental. And in really trying to reconnect with the world, he found the way to do that was through music. He picked up the guitar and began practicing obsessively, learning obsessively, as I say, in juvenile jails and group homes. And then when he finally got out at the age of 17, almost 18, and was released back to his family, he had an ambition, and that was to start a band. And his younger brother Tommy was sort of a wayward child at that point, getting into trouble, had been arrested a few times for shoplifting, and was very much headed down the same path. And Bob kind of scooped him, grabbed him by the scruff of the neck, and said, "Here, you're going to learn how to play bass." And really, that's how the Stinson brothers began making music.
So no exaggeration to say music saved their lives.
It is not an exaggeration at all. And, you know, I asked Tommy Stinson a number of times, do you ever think about what your fate would have been if not for Bob sort of rescuing you and putting the bass in your hands? And he said, you know, it was petty theft. It would have been grand larceny, grand theft, and then who knows, you know, murder. And it certainly would have meant a life in jail. And as the book first section details there, the title is Jail, Death, or Janitor. And that was the answer that Westerberg gave when he was asked, you know, what would any of your fates have been if not for the Replacements, Jail, Death, or Janitor? And I think it was particularly true in the Stinson's case. Guys were all high school dropouts, came from middle or lower middle class environments where there wasn't a whole lot of ambition. You were kind of probably going to do what your dad did if you were lucky, be a sort of a laborer, a worker, a lifer, working a government job. And I don't think any of them wanted that. And I don't think any of them were really cut out or suited for regular day job employment, as it would turn out. But I think what gave them a power was their limitations musically, in terms of their personality. They found each other and clicked in a way, as Paul says in the book, we understood each other in ways that most guys didn't. And I think that's why they came together so quickly. And from the moment that Paul joined the band, within a couple months, they went from having one or two songs to having 20, 30, 40 songs, and really having coalesced as a band and having found this sound together.
So the big thread in your book, Bob, is that this band is a refuge for these trouble boys, as the book is titled.
Right.
And at the same time, you've also got this almost subconscious level of, you know, screwing things up, getting the opportunities, screwing them up.
I think it began with Westerberg. I think Westerberg, if you come to know him, he has a degree of, as I speculate in the book, oppositional defiance syndrome, where he just, if you say black, he says white. You know, he had, I think, problems with authority. And I think if you look at their backgrounds, they all kind of had problems with authority, certainly the Stinsons. And even Chris Mars, in his own quiet way, was a very chaotic sort of force and presence, or could be if he chose to. And so I think, you know, that was another thing that bonded them and propelled them in the way that they performed, in the way they acted in nightclubs, on the road, and ultimately in record company offices and recording studios.
And that seemed to be in place from the very start. Like, what were those first shows like when these guys started playing together?
Well, it's interesting, for a band that would really make its reputation as drinkers, their first couple shows, or two of the first three, came in kind of sober houses and sober dances for teens. You know, Minnesota being the land of 10,000 lakes is also the land of 10,000 rehab centers. In the 70s, I think any kid that got in trouble, they would immediately put them in rehab. out of that, there were, you know, a lot of teens who were sober and they needed entertainment. And so there was a kind of little circuit of sober dances and sober houses that they would play. And as it happened, the Replacements, the first couple gigs they played, the first one, which they played as the Impediments at a place in St. Paul called Team House, which was a sober, chemical-free atmosphere. They got busted in the parking lot for drinking in between sets. And the guy read them the riot act and said, "You'll never play in this town again." Hence the name change from the Impediments to the Replacements. And then they're kind of quote-unquote breakthrough gig, which was for Peter Jesperson, the man who had discovered them and signed them to Twin Tone, was at a place called the Bataclan, again, a kind of chemical-free, sober performance space. And they got caught drinking before the show and never played the gig. They got kicked out before that one. So that was, you know, the scene that Peter walked into, is this band having been booted from the gig before they could play a note.
Peter Jesperson does eventually get to see the band play, and he becomes their manager, their champion. Jesperson gets them signed to Twin Tone Records. It's a local independent label, and they put out Sorry Ma, Forgot to Take Out the Trash, and Stink in 1981 and 82. Just saying those titles makes me smile. It encompasses everything you need to know about the Replacements in that era. How was the band developing as a live band? Because as they begin to cross the country playing behind these records, people are buzzing about them.
I think they evolved into a very tight band because you're talking about an era of American punk and hardcore punk where people wanted their songs fast and tight and together. And although the Replacements could be meandering in between songs, tuning up the first couple years, if you listen to them in 81, 82, really into 83, they were a really tight combo. And I think it was that tightness that allowed them later on to get as loose as they did.
Yeah, well, I never forget the first time I saw them, circa Sorry Ma, Forgot to Take Out the Trash. Mm. They were finished, and they'd had enough, and there were a lot of hardcore kids with mohawks. But Paul was not done. The other guys went to the bar, and Paul sat behind the drums, and he pulled some kids with mohawks out of the audience, and they proceeded to play Louie Louie for half an hour. Badly, horribly. But what it said to me is, here's this band named The Replacements. It was yet another reminder, you can do this.
Right.
Anybody can do this. You can be us.
And I think in a lot of ways, you know, the Replacements get kind of lumped into that sort of DIY American indie era. And I think in some ways they were very opposite of that. None of them drove. They didn't have driver's license, so they couldn't get to the gigs. That's about as un-DIY as you can get. But where I think they do kind of fit into the spirit of that time is about the separation of the band, the artist, and the audience. They would pull people on stage. They would switch instruments. There was this kind of free-flowing quality to who they were and the music they played and the atmosphere they created in those shows, where I think it made people feel like, yeah, I could do that. But more, I think it gave the audience a really deep connection to the band from the get-go. And I think that's partly why they have continued to sort of remain in people's hearts and minds for so long, is because they were closer, I think, to their audience than a lot of bands.
You know, the big part of this band too, Bob, why we're even talking about them today, I think, is because of, you know, Westerberg's songs, but also how they were presented by this band. The band was a key component of the creative thing. You really draw out the essential tension between what Westerberg was trying to write and what the band wanted to play. And there was a sense of, you know, we don't want any ballads, we don't want any slow ones, you know, don't get sentimental on us, Paul. He was fighting against all these kind of tensions within the band about what kind of music they wanted to play, what they would allow him to write. It was almost like he had to sneak in a song like Johnny's Gonna Die early on, something that was a little bit more sensitive.
Johnny always needs more than he takes. Forgets a couple chords, forgets a couple breaks. And everybody tells me that Johnny is hot. Johnny needs something, but he ain't got. And Johnny's gonna die.
Well, and that was the era, too. You know, I think Paul deserves a fair amount of credit because coming out of that early punk and hardcore, American hardcore era, we're talking, you know, 80 to 82, the sort of expression of feeling and emotion and sentiment the way Westerberg would become a master of was fairly verboten. So I think he that evolved. You know, you've got Johnny's Gonna Die on one record, on the first record, you've got Go on the second record, and then you get Within Your Reach on Hootenanny. Then it's clear that, wow, these songs are just as powerful as the dumb fun rockers.
Grow without so much. Can die without it. Live without your touch. I die within your
I think Jesperson, their manager, deserves a lot of credit because early on, Paul was, as early as he was writing all the punk and rock and hardcore songs on Sorry Ma and Stink, he was quietly slipping Jesperson these tapes of these ballads and things. And, you know, maybe another manager, another person wouldn't have encouraged that side of him, but Peter did. And I think that was important in Westerberg's evolution and the evolution of the band ultimately.
You can really hear this incredible dichotomy on Let It Be, which comes out in 1984. We did a classic album dissection of this record once, if you can go back and listen to it on soundopinions.org. But the thing that always strikes both Greg and me is this record can go from a goofy Kiss cover or Tommy Gets His Tonsils Out to Answering Machine or Unsatisfied, these incredible soulful songs about bearing your heart.
You know, that is part of what made the Replacements great, I think. You know, you if you're lucky, a great band will get you in the head and the heart, or the heart or the gut, but very few bands touch you in the head, heart, and gut, all three places. And the Replacements had the ability to...
Maybe also the crotch at times.
Yeah, and the crotch, you know, but I think it's rare that you get a band that has the sort of classic rock and roll qualities, that has the great songs and songwriters and writerly aspect to it, and has a kind of sense of humor as well. I think it's rare, almost non-existent, for a band to sort of tick off all those boxes. And I think that, in a way, is what makes the Replacements so special. In addition to the fact that I think what fans relate to is that they know they're getting a pure, real experience. I think the Replacements were who they were 100% of the time, on stage, off, in their songs, in record company offices, wherever it might have been. And I think people instinctively understood that look, these guys aren't putting on a mask. They're not putting on an act. It's not a show that they sort of turn, or a light switch they turn on and off. It's like, this is who they are. This is what they are. And I think people are attracted to that, you know, realness, for lack of a better term. But I think that's the thing that really shines through with the Replacements, even 25 years after their career in the main is over.
When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Replacements biographer Bob Mayer, picking up with the band's move to a major label, and later, a review of the new album from Solange and a look at the soul sample driving a Drake hit. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.